these words, out of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. And then in Romans, I'll just read a few verses from Romans chapter 13, starting in verse 8. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be, are summed up in this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Let's welcome Kyle as he comes up to preach.
Thank you, Dave. Good morning, Jubilee. It's wonderful to be with you. Won't you please keep Exodus 20 open? If you have a Bible, won't you keep it open at Exodus chapter 20? We are concluding our series in the Ten Commandments this morning. I hope it's been a helpful series for you. One of the goals of studying the Ten Commandments is that our moral intuitions would line up with God's. We all have moral intuitions. They come from a variety of sources, the family you grew up in, the media you consume, maybe the place where you studied. But the challenge for us is to make sure that our moral intuitions are God's moral intuitions. But that's not an automatic process. And so there's huge value in going back to the Bible to see what it is that God has said, what it is that God says is right and wrong, and how we can embrace that and learn to live it out. And as we do, we'll find that God's rules, God's commands actually facilitate our flourishing. And we're going to see that this morning as we wrap up with the final command, you shall not covet. You shall not covet. So we're going to think firstly about what coveting is, the nature of coveting. And the first thing we should notice about this particular command is that coveting is internal. Coveting is internal. To covet something is to desire something. It's to crave something. It's to hanker after something, to long for it, to want to have it. And it's important to notice that this prohibition is a little bit different from the others, because the others, especially the ones that have just preceded it, are focused on behaviors. You shall not lie or steal. But the prohibition here isn't about the behavior, but about the desire. The desire itself is sinful. The desire itself is wrong. And what this command shows us is that the law is meant to be an internal thing. It's not just about behavior, but about the heart. God isn't just concerned about the externals, but God is concerned about the internals, because your internal desires always precede your external actions. You don't do anything on the outside that hasn't first started to develop on the inside. And so this command tells us that even your desires can be sinful. Even your desires can be illegitimate. Even before it's reached the level of behavior, you can have sinned and broken God's law. And so we're commanded not to covet, not to inordinately desire something, not to crave or long for something. So that's the first aspect about this internal coveting. But notice the second part of this coveting is that it attaches itself to specific objects. Take a look at verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house or your neighbor's spouse or your neighbor's servant or ox or donkey or anything. You know, it's possible to think, well, I think I can say with a clear conscience, I've never coveted a donkey. Whenever I see a donkey, I don't feel any kind of desire to own it. I'm glad I don't own it, to be honest, when I see a donkey. I think, oh, I wouldn't like to have that. But of course, this is set in a kind of ancient Near Eastern context. And the point here is that you shouldn't covet what other people have. You shouldn't covet specific objects. You see, your internal desires, which can seem a little bit abstract, like I've just got these desires, I don't know where they're going, but those desires always attach themselves to specific objects. You know, whether it's watches, smartphones, cars, TVs, computers, you know. You notice this when you go to a shopping center. There are just objects there that are seeking attachment. You know, those objects need desires to be attached to them. And advertisers and producers have put those there so that they'll see, you know, which desires that you have will map onto the variety of objects that we've got in this place. But we can even desire or covet people. The command talks about a neighbor's wife or spouse. You can even over-desire a person, a relationship with a person. Think, if I have that person, everything will be okay, I'll be happy. And so although coveting is an internal desire, it always attaches itself very concretely to specific objects, to specific things, to specific people, perhaps. To covet something is to desire a person or a thing inordinately, to crave that person or that thing, to want it so badly that you'll hanker after it, you think about it, you daydream about it, you think, if I have that person or that thing, I'll be happy and joyful and everything will be okay. Of course, the poster boy for coveting is Gollum. If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, you'll know that Gollum desires the ring. He hankers after it. Now, originally, Gollum was known as Smeagol, but his life changes when he encounters the ring. In fact, his friend Deagle finds it first, and if you've watched the movie, and I'm sorry to quote from the movie for all the purists out there, but I think we can agree it's the most widely accessed version of the narrative, so we'll go with that. When they find the ring, Deagle is Smeagol's best friend, and the ring immediately triggers desires in Smeagol, and he has to have it, he has to get it. And it starts to immediately corrupt him. This covetous desire immediately starts to work on Smeagol's heart, and in the end leads him to destructive behavior as he murders his best friend in order to obtain the ring. You see, the ring, as you'll know, is what Gollum ends up calling his precious thing, the thing he delights in, the thing that he craves. It's interesting that the noun form of the Hebrew verb for covet could be translated a precious thing. It's the thing that you find precious. Your idolatrous desires attach onto something specific, and that thing becomes precious to you. Maybe it's your phone. Maybe your phone is your precious. You can't leave it behind. You can't leave it anywhere without thinking about it, without needing it, needing to be with it, needing to look at it, needing to touch it. It's the thing you crave. Maybe it's something else though. Maybe it's not a phone. Maybe it's your car. Maybe it's your house. It could be anything. That's the way this command goes. There could be anything, any specific object or person that you attach your desires to. So what is that thing for you? What is the thing that you find precious? The thing that you can't do without? The thing that affects your mood states, whether you have it or don't have it? The thing that you long for? You see, coveting is an internal desire, but it always attaches itself to a specific object. And the first step in dealing with coveting in our lives is identifying what those objects are. What are those things that I find myself attracted to? And then more than that, why do I find that so attractive? Why do I find that so desirable? You see, coveting works at the level of motivation, the level of desire. And so it's not enough just to hear from the pulpit, don't covet. Because in Romans chapter 7, the Apostle Paul says, when the Lord told me not to covet, all that did was highlighted how much coveting I really do. The law can expose the desire, but it can't transform the desire. So the first step is to try and figure out, why do I have that desire for those specific things? Why is it that I have such an inordinate desire for that particular thing? For the phone or the car or this or that or the degree or the job or that person? We're not going to be able to deal with that desire at the motivational level until we can first understand it and identify it. And it's a little bit different for different people. So you've got to do that work for yourself. You've got to try and identify, why is it that I am attracted particularly to those particular objects, to those particular people, or those particular things? What's going on in my heart that is leading me to those things? One final distinction about coveting. Coveting can refer to an inordinate desire, and that's how it gets developed in the Bible, that coveting is this over-desire for things, and it could even be good things. You could have a desire for a relationship that starts out as normal and healthy, and it grows and morphs and gets oversized and becomes inordinate, and therefore turns into a kind of coveting that becomes sinful. But coveting can also refer to a kind of, let's say, mid-sized desire for something that you shouldn't have in the first place. And that's actually the focus here of this command. You shouldn't covet something someone else has, your neighbor's spouse or their property or their goods. You see, your desire can be mild for an illegitimate object, and it's therefore an illegitimate desire. So don't wait for it to get supersized before you deal with it. Just realize right up front, I have this desire for something I shouldn't desire. Let me deal with it right now before it grows. It becomes a lot harder to deal with coveting once those desires morph and get a foothold in our hearts. So the best thing we can do is to identify them as soon as possible, to deal with them as quickly as possible. So coveting is internal, but secondly, coveting occurs in a social context. That's the second thing about coveting that we should notice. Take a look at verse 17 again of Exodus 20. There's a word that comes up three times. Can you see what it is? It is the word neighbor. You see, the 10th commandment is the most neighborly of the commandments in this sense. The word occurs three times, the only time in the 10 commandments. And so Walter Brueggemann, who's an Old Testament scholar, speculates that it is as though this is the original statement of a faith perspective that finally concerns the well-being of the neighbor. The prohibition of covetousness was the foundation of Israelite society because it meant you had to recognize the personhood and the property of your neighbor. You had to recognize that I was part of a society where other people had things that were theirs and I couldn't just covet them, which in the end, of course, would lead to taking them. Brueggemann goes on to say that acknowledgement of the neighbor, the neighbor's presence, and the neighbor's property is indispensable for a viable social order. Acknowledging your neighbor's presence and property is viable, is indispensable for a viable social order. And because this command has been disobeyed historically in South Africa and even in the present, we've seen why there is so much injustice and unrest today. Because the personhood and the property of our neighbors has not been acknowledged in the past or often in the present. And because we've treated people like that, the social order unravels as neighbors are trampled over in the pursuit of material gain. So this command prohibits inordinate desire and the desire for something particularly that belongs to someone else. It's your neighbor's thing that you are prohibited from coveting. And it is remarkable when you think of the wisdom of this command that not only has the rejection of this command created such problems in the world, in our country, you'd think that maybe by this stage, as a culture, would think, you know, maybe there's some wisdom here. We should really start to embrace this command. But our culture still enthusiastically rejects this command because instead of this desire as being something that should be resisted, this desire is something that is actively encouraged and stimulated across our culture in a variety of ways. Maybe the most obvious is the stimulation of this desire of covetousness in advertising and marketing. I think one of the kind of, you know, insights of the advertising model is recognizing that people have desires that can be inflamed, that can be encouraged. And what you have to do is get, you know, images or pictures or promises of things that people want in order to motivate them to make purchases, in order to generate economic activity. And so we are in a culture where this desire in our social context is actively encouraged. Wherever we go, we are confronted with objects that are attractive. And you think, yeah, I didn't know I needed that, but maybe I do. I didn't know I wanted it, but now I feel a desire for it. And so we're in a social context where that is encouraged. But this can happen in any social context. Of course, the ancient Israelites weren't getting, you know, spam email about products. They didn't have to deal with that. But coveting can happen in any social context, right? Even at a braai, even at church, where you see your neighbor, you have an opportunity to covet. So wherever you have your neighbor's presence, in a sense, you've got a decision to make in terms of how you're going to relate to your neighbor. Of course, this can happen informally in person. It can even happen informally online, on social media comparison sites, where you're looking at your friends and what they have, and wow, I didn't know they went on that amazing holiday. I haven't been on a holiday like that, for a long time. And so as you kind of see what other people are getting up to on these various kind of comparison websites like Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, you start to feel that desire to have the life your friend has, to have the things that your friend has. Our social context always affords us an opportunity to covet. So this is what I think you've got going on. You've got the Velcro hooks of covetousness in your heart, and then you've got the Velcro loops of covetousness in society. And those Velcro hooks in your heart and those Velcro loops in your social context find each other and they attach. And the goal of advertising, of course, is that that attachment means someone's clicked and there's a purchase that's been made. But it can happen without a kind of economic transaction occurring. And so we've got to realize that we've got these desires in our hearts, but they occur within a social context. And we need to identify for ourselves what are my desires and in which social contexts am I attracted to which specific objects. When I hang out with these people, these are the things I end up coveting. When I hang out with those people, those are the things I end up coveting. And why? What's going on internally that makes those particular objects or people so attractive to me? So that's the nature of coveting. It is an internal desire for something someone else has. It's an over-desire. But when we give in to this desire, it has significant and negative consequences. So let's move from the nature of coveting to the consequences of coveting. And what we're going to see is that the consequences of coveting are nothing less than absolutely disastrous. Once again, we'll see that God's word is designed to protect us, to help us, to bless us, and we ignore what God says at our own peril. The first set of consequences the Bible teaches us about are the temporal social consequences of coveting, the temporal social consequences. You see this specifically in the prophets. Again and again and again, the prophets rebuke those who covet. Amos in particular shows us that the consequences of covetousness are social injustice. Much of what happens in social injustice is caused by the sin of covetousness. So for example, Amos chapter 2, verse 6. This is what the Lord says, "For three sins of Israel, even for four, I will not relent. They sell the innocent for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals." The reference there is probably to the law courts, that the innocent were being, there was bribery happening, and the innocent were being condemned for silver or even a pair of sandals. They trample on the heads of the poor as on the dust of the ground and deny justice to the oppressed. Because of the desire for silver or because of the desire even for a pair of sandals, those in need are trampled on. Amos chapter 5, verse 11 and 12. "You levy a straw tax on the poor and impose a tax on their grain. Therefore, though you have built stone mansions, you will not live in them. Though you have planted lush vineyards, you will not drink their wine. For I know how many are your offenses and how great your sins. There are those who oppress the innocent and take bribes and deprive the poor of justice in the courts." You see, coveting begins in the heart, but it doesn't stay there. It ends up going into society, and the thing that becomes precious to you becomes the operating principle of your life. And so you'll trample on anyone or anything in the process to get it. If you desire material gain, then people become expendable, and you'll trample over people in order to get what you covet. If you like, the kind of personal, psychological, spiritual problems of coveting become sociological. They become communal, they become systemic as we trample over people to get what we want, as justice is perverted. And just in case we think that's kind of an Old Testament prophet thing, we find repeated warnings about it in the New Testament as well. Here's just one example, James chapter 5. James says, "Now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth has rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter." There is a trampling over people in order to accumulate wealth. That's what happens when we give in to the sin of covetousness. The most precious thing means that everything else becomes expendable. In order to obtain that precious thing, whether it's wealth, whatever it is, becomes the only kind of thing that motivates or guides you. People become expendable. People get trampled over. People get exploited. In fact, the breaking of this command means that you break the other commands. You don't steal unless you first covet. You don't commit adultery unless you first covet. Often there's lying that takes place because of coveting. You see, without this desire at play, a lot of those other behaviors don't ever happen. But when this desire is in play, all these temporal consequences result. In the Bible, again and again and again, we see that a variety of sinful behaviors are rooted in the sin of covetousness. Well, Smeagol's a good example of this. He's willing to murder his best friend in order to get the ring, in order to satisfy his unquenchable desire for the ring. Tolkien brilliantly understands human beings. He understands how the heart works. He understands how coveting works. And Gollum is a kind of literary case study of how coveting results in social destruction, as Gollum kind of just ends up shipwrecking all of the relationships around him. But it's easy to look at Gollum and think, oh, of course, that's really bad coveting. I thank the Lord that I don't do that kind of coveting, you know. There's all this terrible stuff that happens, but I don't do that. Well, that would be a naive understanding of this command, right? To deal with coveting in our lives, we first have to recognize that this is something that at some level humans struggle with. Every person. If you have a pulse, you struggle with this sin. It's so endemic to human nature that it is something we all struggle with. And it is something that doesn't look like it is leaving our society anytime soon. However, it doesn't just have temporal social consequences. The sin of coveting has eternal personal consequences. You see, you might think, okay, we all covet, fine, but I covet in a socially responsible way. You know, my coveting doesn't result in injustice. I only buy fair trade goods. I only buy sort of really tailor-made items. So I've made sure that when I make purchases, everyone wins and there are no negative social consequences to my coveting. Well, the sin of coveting, even if done in a socially responsible way, is still serious enough to shipwreck your relationship with God. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 5, the Apostle Paul says this, "For of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure, or greedy person," so that word greedy there is really the word that links up with coveting, greediness. "Such a person is an idolater." It's kind of Paul's like, FYI, if you do those things, you're an idolater. So you've also broken the second command. "That person has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God." You see, coveting will keep you out of God's kingdom because God's kingdom is actually not the thing you want when you covet. You want something else. And so coveting keeps you out of God's kingdom because coveting, by definition, is you wanting something other than God's kingdom. And so when you don't get into God's kingdom, it's because you didn't want it in the first place. Coveting prevents you from entering the kingdom of God. It's the sign of a heart that does not know the love of God, that has not tasted the love of God. You know, in that verse, it almost seems like Paul's overreacting. But if we can just put it up again, we'll see that Paul's actually wanting us to be sure of something. He's saying, be sure of this. Be clear about this. This is something you can bank on. If you participate in this, if this has gripped your heart, you will not enter the kingdom of Christ. And one of the challenges, I think, with this sin is that it is socially acceptable to covet. It's just so normal. Just feels so natural. But because it's socially acceptable, doesn't mean it's spiritually acceptable. It doesn't mean that God finds it acceptable. Going back to Exodus, if you have it open with you, do you notice that the command is repeated? You shall not covet your neighbor's house. Then again, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey or anything. Why is it repeated? I think it's repeated because almost more than any of the others, the deceitfulness of this desire tricks us. I don't think I covet. I don't think I'm walking around coveting. But usually when an object I like is removed from me and I realize, oh, that was actually very precious to me. Now it's gone and I'm unhappy. And the depth of my unhappiness is a reflection of the depth of my desire for that thing. And it's so deceitful. We think we're not doing it, and yet we are guilty of it. It's no surprise, therefore, that Jesus himself warns us about these. In Luke chapter 12, Jesus said to the crowds, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." And he told them this parable: "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?'" And this is Jesus' conclusion: "This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich toward God." You see, even when coveting doesn't have negative social consequences, it still pushes God out of your life. You know, in this parable, there's nothing negative said about the social consequences of his coveting, but he's not being rich towards God. And so when we covet, we're being rich to ourselves, but not towards God, not towards our neighbor. And so when we covet, we break God's law and we stand condemned under God's law. It's important to notice that, I think, as we wrap up the series, the Ten Commandments should be obeyed, but aren't obeyed. Not by us, at any rate. We can't obey these. We break God's law. And maybe you think, well, yeah, but fine, some of them. I break some of God's law, but not the whole thing. But the thing about God's law is when you break some of it, you break all of it. Let me give you an example. When I was younger, my brothers and I had to get babysat on I think it was a Saturday. My mom was working. I think we were about 8 or 9 years old, and she had obviously a very good friend who would babysit three boys of 8 to 11 years old. And we were playing in the garden and playing soccer. And unusually, my soccer skill wasn't up to scratch. And I kicked the ball into the big living room window and it broke. And of course, my mom's friend was understandably upset. But the thing is, the whole window didn't break. If I had to guess, I would say 30% of the window broke. And while she was shouting at me, I thought, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but to be fair, the whole window's not broken. 70% of it is still there. It's really that top left corner that's broken. The whole thing, you know, most of it's still fine." Of course, I didn't say that because I didn't want to aggravate the situation. But when you break a part of a window, you break the whole thing. And when you break part of God's law, you break God's law. And you stand under God's righteous judgment. And that's where we belong. As law breakers, we stand under God's righteous judgment. And that is why it is such good news that when it comes to the consequences of coveting, Jesus took our place. Jesus, the righteous one, who was never guilty of coveting, became our substitute and bore God's judgment on our behalf. And now, because of that, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ. We are forgiven and we are cleansed. And more than that, our desires start to get transformed because we realize that we have been loved by God when we were his enemies. And so we start to love him in return. We start to love him back. Which means that the love we have for material possessions starts to diminish. The kind of vice grip that possessions have on our hearts starts to get loosened. Our love for Christ starts to replace our love for objects and even other people, so that our love for Christ becomes the main love that motivates our life. And unless you get to that level, you'll never really be able to deal with coveting unless you get to the level of your desires and your motives, you'll never be able to make headway in resisting these covetous desires. So a love for Christ really is the only thing that can help us deal with this problem. The love of Christ pushes out love for material objects or people. Not so that we don't value those things or people, but that Christ becomes number one. But then, when the heart gets transformed, the behaviors start to get transformed as well. And so what does that mean as it relates to this command? And we'll wrap up with this. What is the converse of coveting? Remember how the Ten Commandments work? Every command has a flip side. Every negative command has a positive ideal that we should be aiming towards. And so what is it for coveting? Well, personally, at the individual level, it's contentment. The goal here for us is contentment. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6 says, "Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that." Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5, "Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, 'Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you.'" Do you notice the logic of that verse? How is it that you can be content? And again, think about your desires. You can be content because you have a relationship with God. That is the logic of that injunction. Unless your relationship with God is more desirable to you than possessions, that command doesn't work. And that's why I'm trying to emphasize the importance of your desires. You've got to find your relationship with God far more desirable and valuable than anything else you have. As God's children, we actually have the most precious thing. And it's not a smartphone or a house or a car. It is God Himself. God Himself is the most precious thing in all the universe. And through Jesus Christ, we have a relationship with Him. We have access to Him. He has become our treasure. He has become our precious thing. And because of that, money, possessions lose their grip on our hearts. So at an individual level, that's what this command is pushing us towards, contentment. At a social level, we should be doing good and being generous. Again, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17, "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life." One of the ways that we can protect ourselves from coveting is by doing good and being generous. By sharing, by giving, by cultivating generosity, you are safeguarding your heart against coveting. And if you do that, I love verse 19, you'll take hold of the life that is truly life. Remember what Jesus says, life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. You're not valuable because you own valuable things. You're valuable because God made you and loves you. And when you learn to give and to share, you're taking hold of real life, not fake life, like pseudo life, like the life in the catalogs, and you know, you just want these nice appliances, and you're taking hold of something real that's gonna last for all of eternity. Rather than coveting our neighbor's things, we should love our neighbor. And I think as we end the series, it's helpful to look at Romans 13, because that's where the Apostle Paul takes all of this. Romans 13, "The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be, are summed up in this one command: love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law." We obey the Ten Commands when we love our neighbor. when we do good, when we're generous, when we care, and we're motivated to love our neighbor because God has loved us when we didn't deserve it, when we were his enemies, when we hated him, when we rejected him, God loved us. And because we've been on the receiving end of love, we can now show that love and care to others. And when you receive God's love, it changes you at the level of desires and motives. It impacts your heart and empowers you to love those around you.